Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich.
How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is completely self-funded, produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. Consider making a small donation to support the podcast. Go to bit.ly/support, G, T, and podcast. I repeat, bit.ly/support GT podcast. Thank you so much. And for more information, please visit Natalie's website, join the podcast Instagram page, and subscribe to the newsletter to receive updates on future episodes. So if you've been listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma podcast for a while, you will have heard me or our guests speak about the term ACEs, which is short for adverse childhood experiences. Adverse childhood experiences are traumatic experiences that children experience before the age of 18 that can have lasting impacts on their mental health, physical health, and general well-being. Since my first education and profession as a teacher, I have been interested and invested in the well-being of children and what impacts their ability to thrive in their lives. As a psychological therapist and grief and trauma expert, I am faced with people's life experiences on a daily basis and can see the impact and effect adverse childhood experiences have on their personal life, both past and present. So when Mark Hauser reached out to me to be a guest on the podcast, I was especially interested in this specific science-based background and knowledge that he brings to the topic of ACEs. In his just published book, Vulnerable Minds, he provides a new scientific and humanistic understanding of how different types of adversity create a unique signature of trauma, scarring the developing child's body and brain. So with this, I look forward to finding out more from our guest this week, not just about the trauma that children have experienced throughout their early lives, but also of the hope for these children, enabling them with greater resilience to and to recover from trauma. About this week's guest, Mark Hauser's scientific research, including over 300 published papers and 7 books, has focused on how the brain evolves, develops, and is altered by damage and neurodevelopmental disorders, with an emphasis on the process of learning and decision making, as well as the impact of traumatic experiences on development. His educational and consulting work has focused on the implementation of quantitative, brain-based methods for teachers, clinicians, and doctors working with children who have different disabilities, including especially those that result from a history of traumatic experiences. Mark has earned a Bachelor of Science degree from Bucknell University, a PhD from UCLA, and postdoctoral fellowship from the University of Michigan, Rockefeller University, and University of California, Davis. For almost 20 years, he was a professor at Harvard University. In 2013, he founded the company Risk Eraser, dedicated to providing software and consulting to programs focusing on students in special education. His most recent book, Vulnerable Minds, has just been published in March 2024 by Avery Penguin Random House Publishing in New York. So congratulations on your recently published book, Mark.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Pleased to be here today.
Thank you for being here and taking a bit of time to telling us about you, your life. But first of all, let me ask you, how are you today?
I'm reasonably good. I should just, before I logged on to speak with you today, I was FaceTiming with my 91-year-old father who lives in France. And I just lost my mother about a year ago, and he and I were just reminiscing. And of course, he was, you know, sad about it. He said something that he's said to me frequently is that, you know, why do I get to enjoy my life and my wife of 70 years is no longer? And so, you know, it's a constant reminder for both of us of the person we had in our life for so long and not, her not being around and both of us having lots of memories of her. And so, you know, I speak to him almost every day ever since my mom passed away, and FaceTime, you know, teaching my 85-year-old dad about iPhones and FaceTime was quite the challenge. even though he was a very distinguished physicist. But it's really been a revolution for him in keeping in touch with me. And so it's a really nice way to connect with someone who's had a tremendous loss that we both had.
Yeah. Well, especially when you said 70 years of marriage, not many couples bring it to that number. And you just started by answering my next question, which is always the question of tell us a little bit about how your life and has been informed by grief and trauma.
Yeah. So I think, for me, there's a whole series of experiences that I've had over my lifetime that have shaped me in many ways. The loss of my mom, which is only a year ago. So it's, a fairly new and somewhat raw experience. Was an interesting one for me in many ways, in part just because my mom lived a very long life. I mean, she died and she was, almost 90 years old. And I think I had set myself up for a long time, knowing that she had been sick for a couple of years, that, I knew I'd be sad, but I also knew that I had an incredible run with an amazing mother, and that there was no regrets, that she really lived the longest, richest possible life and was an extraordinary mother. So, of course, losing someone is always hard, but it's not like she was sick early in life and I only get to be with her for, a very short period of time. So that was important because I think in the end, it strengthened me knowing that I had an incredible opportunity to be with an amazing mother who modeled what it's like to be an amazing parent. And so it was just an interesting way of thinking about that kind of loss. And I put it into context with a very close friend of mine whose son died just a couple of years ago from an overdose. And I've always thought about that in context of how those are the kinds of losses that are just so hard to wrestle with because there's such an unfortunate loss and you should never have your child, die before you. And just the difference in that kind of relationship. And so it's put into relief for me just thinking about different kinds of losses and ones that seem so unnecessary that this person shouldn't have lost their life at such an early age, either due to a disease or neglect or something like that, which I see all the time because I work with children. I see losses all the time. And so those are very different than the ones like my mom, where she had a long life. She had a very rich life and she maximized that period of time. So I think those kinds of losses have shaped my own thinking around it and my own way of dealing with them. And then I think there are other kinds of experiences that have really been formative in terms of grief and loss and trauma. I was, as I sort of mentioned to many people, when I was a teenager, I was very, very badly bullied for several years. And that's, a different kind of experience that really shaped who I was in realizing the importance of support systems. Yeah. That my parents were there for me to support me. And then, my father was a child running through Nazi-occupied France during the Holocaust. And his entire family was, annihilated by the Nazis. And that's a different kind of loss. So he went through his entire life with only his parents because the rest of the family was killed. Mm-hmm. So that's, thinking about another kind of loss that entire family lineage was never part of my life because they were gone. And then, our youngest daughter, who we adopted from an orphanage when she was two, the loss she had of not having, her biological parents. And so those are the kinds of experiences that really shaped me. And then in addition, of course, all the children I work with in schools, who have and are living through extraordinary loss of trust and relationships with family members and others.
Mm. Yeah, and loss and trauma is always, or in some kinds, intertwined. So loss bears trauma and trauma bears loss to a certain degree without going into too much of that detail. But what has brought you specifically to the field of I mean, you're working with children, but also to the field of studying the science behind ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, which I shortly introduced in the beginning. But what has brought you to be interested in that specifically?
Yeah. So I think the real inspiration for the work and the science behind it was the realization that many practitioners in the field who work in particular with children, where the term trauma comes up, to me, that what was striking was that there was an extraordinary amount of science out in the published literature, the academic literature, that wasn't really making its way into the hands of the practitioners. And when I say practitioners, I really mean a broad swath of people, from psychiatrists and counselors in schools to doctors and nurses and social workers and teachers, as well as the legal profession. Because, of course, in many of the children that I work with, there are legal issues, whether it's neglect or abuse or criminal involvement. But lawyers who seem to be unfamiliar with the science that was in some ways tucked away in scientific academic papers that most people probably would never read. So for me, as someone who has written books for the general public, my interest in the science and bringing it to bear for a general audience was letting people be aware of the richness of the science and the implications it has for treatment and recovery. In part because, of course, it's one thing describing how the body and brain are impacted by different kinds of adversity. It's another thing helping people recover from that and build resilience against future adversity. And because of my interest in not just the Western world, but a very broad cross-cultural population, I also wanted to bring to bear the variety of different kinds of experiences that children are exposed to, and that we need a much broader recovery resilience lens because of cross-cultural differences, that what one person calls neglect is maybe not the same thing that somebody else calls neglect, and similar for abuse and other kinds of adversity that children may experience. So, you know, my main goal, I guess, was to make the broadest population of practitioners whose job it is to help children be aware of the richness of the science so that we all can do a better job of helping children.
And this is very important, but I'm wondering, how did these people get to know about or understand it in layman's term, the science behind ACEs? I mean, we spoke about prior to our recording that I spoke about ACEs or developmental trauma before. And yes, not everyone listens to the podcast, but how do we reach those people, and how do we make them understand it in basic terms? What is your take on that?
I think the goal of good science writing for the public is translating the richness of the science, not dumbing it down, is to treat the audience with respect, but explain it in such a way that it's useful, that's practical. And I think it's a real art. I think podcasts like yours are one vehicle for disseminating information like this. So let me just maybe give an example. In some ways, we now understand quite a bit about how different kinds of adversity really can transform and scar, which of course is what the word trauma really means, scar the body and brain. And when I say body and brain, I really mean three core systems of functioning in human beings and other animals, and that's the immune system, the autonomic system, and the neural system. And adversity affects all three of those. And that's really important to understand, because when we think about treatment, we have to understand that all those three systems are potentially affected in a negative way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're not going in there and going, I'm going to just look at the brain. Because first of all, most practitioners don't have the tools to just look at the brain, because that requires tools that are often not in a therapist's office, like a brain scanner. But what sometimes can be affected are how, for example, the autonomic system works, how heart rate and breathing are affected, or the immune system, that when you go to a doctor and they look at things like your hormone levels or your cortisol levels, those are things that can be looked at by a doctor if they understand that adversity affects the immune system. And I think, you know, one of the ways into coming back to this idea of adverse childhood experiences that I think is really helpful, hopefully, for some of your listeners, is the originator of the kind of concept in some ways of adverse childhood experiences, Dr. Vincent Felitti, was a preventative medicine doctor in Southern California, still is, he's alive today. And he was working with a population of people who were morbidly obese, and he had developed a mechanism to bring their weight down over the period of a year. And the real inspiration for his work came from a patient he had who he had helped bring their weight down by a dramatic level. And then, as the case is always with obesity and reducing weight, is there's going to be a monitoring period. And with one of his clients, whose name was Patty, he noticed that she was gaining weight back after losing a lot of weight. And he asked her, is there something going on that might explain what's happening to you? And she said, well, you know, this is going to sound a little strange, but I live by myself. And when I wake up in the morning, there are pots and pans in the kitchen, and I must be sleep eating. He goes, well, that's possible. Is there anything else going on? She says, well, yes, I'm having kind of sexual relationships with an older gentleman in my workplace. How do you feel about that? He asked her. Not so well. You know, why not? Because when I was a young child, I was sexually raped by my grandfather. And that was not only a shock in the moment to hear such a tragic, you know, difficult thing, but it was shocking to him because as a preventative doctor, he had never bothered to ask the question about someone's childhood. And so here's a perfect example of why, when doctors are treating patients, adults in the case, that's important to understand something about their histories, because those childhood histories can leave these long-term imprints on the body and brain that may show up as something like obesity. And so it's really important for the practitioners who work with children, especially because it's those young brains that are the most plastic and both vulnerable, but also open to change if the right interventions come in, that we need to understand the variety of ways in which the autonomic, immune, and neural systems are affected so that we can treat them.
Yeah. I like so much of this. I don't know where to start, but I'm also reminded that in your book, you use these examples just like you did now. You're telling stories, and that's where people can understand, okay, yes, I know someone who might be like that. And more importantly, I think it is also from what you're saying, I've been reminded that it's not just doctors or people working with children, because I'm working mostly with adults, but in each adult, this adult is bringing their childhood with it, and they're bringing their, hopefully not just adverse, but their childhood experiences with them. And so this is where we have to look at the broader picture. And I'm also reminded that certain people in my surroundings or people that talk about therapies, they say, oh, I don't want to talk about my childhood. But it's important to understand if there is something that has been impacted significantly that can leave a lasting impact, it is so important to not be overlooked.
Yes, that's right. And I think I would add to what you said, which I completely agree with, is that it's not only the childhood of someone that is going to potentially impact their adult functioning, but generations of childhood, that the parents of the child can bring traumatic experiences to bear on how they raise a child. And, you know, just to come back to my own example at the beginning, my parents, my dad's parents, they really created a story for my dad that was in many ways, your listeners may be familiar with the movie Life is Beautiful, that tells the story about, you know, a father who creates almost an imaginary world for his child during the Holocaust so that the child is in some ways protected. And in some ways, my parents' parents were always there for him to create this thing that you're going to be okay. And, you know, my parents always did that for me as growing up during the time when I was being badly bullied. They were always there. And so that's a positive way. But the negative ones also happen, too, that the trauma that a parent has experienced can be carried into their parenting. And, you know, I'm reminded in this case of what many of us are suffering through either directly or indirectly, which are the wars going on in Ukraine and Gaza as we speak today. And we know, you know, here again, to bring some of the science to bear on this, that mothers who are exposed to war, as the mothers in Ukraine and Gaza are experiencing today, one of the systems that it directly impacts is the neural circuitry of empathy. If you think about empathy in its simplest sense of I can emotionally put myself in your shoes, if that system is knocked out, a mother can't possibly be a loving, rich, enriched mother because she's not recognizing the cues that the child is giving of need. And in its most fundamental sense, what strong attachment is between mother, father, and child is people often equate to kind of a tennis match. Baby serves up a need or child serves up a need and parent returns the serve. And that doesn't mean that every serve, you know, should be returned. If a three-year-old says, I need a smartphone, tough luck. You're not getting the smartphone. But in general, when attachment works in a beautiful way, that serve and return relationship is timely and it meets the needs of the child as they develop. If the empathy system is knocked out, that relationship can't happen because mothers and fathers are not putting themselves in the shoes of their child and therefore can't meet the needs. More importantly, well, not more importantly, but equally importantly, that child now is not getting empathy modeled. Yeah. And that child now will have less pro-social behavior. And so these things have cataclysmic effects that are long-ranging because, again, the science is very clear. Dr. Ruth Feldman, who has done this work in Gaza, actually, she's an Israeli neurobiologist. This work has been done with children living in Gaza who are now experiencing it all over again, and so are the mothers. The science is very clear. The implications are massive. You now have children whose systems of empathy have been literally kind of knocked out. And now going forward into their adult lives, if they survive what's going on, are people whose empathy has been buffered.
Yeah. So while you were speaking, I reflected on my own childhood in terms of what you said prior to talking about the wars. And I realized that I think even in a general sense, like I can see how my upbringing is informing me consciously or unconsciously about me being a parent to my daughter. But as an example of generational trauma, even my father was hit by his parents or father, and he prided himself of not hitting me and my sister. But what he did, he was verbally abusive. So he changed the mean, but he couldn't actually change the narrative. So that to the point where I'm now a mother and I hear myself say things to my daughter that I think, it's like becoming automatic. I'm not verbally abusive, I think. No, definitely not as my father. But there's a thing that carries forward, even in a situation where we're not affected by secondary trauma like a war here in Switzerland. But it still brings back to, well, what do I want to do with the trauma that lives in me, whether that is my father's trauma, generational trauma, whatever. But I am in the here and now, and what can I do so that it doesn't translate just immediately forward to the next generation? What is your experience of having worked with children? And you mentioned there this beautiful term that I'd like to use here, So childhood adversity create unique signatures of trauma. Maybe tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I'm really keen to share with people, and I think it's not well understood or known at least, is that we tend to use the term trauma in a very kind of generic way. I mean that in two senses. One, the term trauma has become kind of the part of the colloquial language. So, you know, I kind of tell a story of a close friend of mine where I was downtown in a town and I saw him. He looked very, very upset. And I said, you know, hey, you know, what's going on? He goes, this is like the worst day of my life. I'm like, well, what happened? I said, my son's soccer match was canceled. I said, if that's the worst day of your life, I want to have your life. And that was a sense of kind of, you know, the notion of a kind of a traumatic experience that I think is not what we're talking about here today. So that's the first part, is that I think the term has entered into the colloquialism of daily life in a way that in some ways I think undermines what you and I are speaking about today. And I think certainly is what is often clinically meant by trauma in things like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual by clinicians, which has tended to be something that's formally really a response to often violent experiences, whether it's a direct abuse or exposure to domestic violence or community violence or war. I want to take that term and I want to make it much more specific. And the reason for that is because different types of adverse experiences lead to different effects or potentially different effects on the developing body and brain. Let's make, as a simple starting point, a distinction between neglect on the one hand and abuse on the other. We now know, and this is again where the science is really important, from both studies of non-human animals and studies of humans, our own species. And our reason why I'm bringing up the animal work, the non-human animal work, is because that's where the detailed experimental science has really shaped our understanding of how these different types of experience, neglect on the one hand, abuse on the other, result in very different kinds of traumatic responses or signatures, as I call them. Mm-hmm. That's important, not just because of the science's discovery, but because we need to recognize these different traumatic signatures so that we can intervene in the correct way. If we just say, this is a child with a traumatic history, I don't know what to do with that. That doesn't tell me anything. Whereas if I say, the traumatic signature of neglect or deprivation is such that this important part of the brain, which does short-term working memory, attention, self-regulation, is undermined because the brain's development is enriched by the necessary experiences. That's one type of signature. Whereas abuse leads to a child who's on kind of high alert and vigilant to the world because the world is dangerous. That's a very, very different kind of response. And so the science is really helpful in this case because it's giving us a sense of, in the same way that each of us have individual signatures of our identity, of who we are, these different types of adversity leave different signatures that inform how we can help children recover, what they need to recover from those experiences.
So that leads me to the next question, which is also about a signature. You mentioned the signatures of resilience. So are they, they are probably tied to those signatures of trauma. So what are they and what can I imagine those to be or look like, those signatures of resilience?
Yeah, so let me paint a little picture for people listening to get sort of an idea in their heads. So imagine we have kind of a scale or a spectrum that goes from, let's say, on the left side, highly vulnerable, and on the right side, highly resilient. The first part to appreciate is that that scale is something that can change over our lifetimes. And the scale is determined by both nature and nurture and the interaction between the two. So some of us are born, because of our biology, far more resilient than others, and some are born far more vulnerable just because of our biology, okay? Again, I'll come back to the story of my father, but there are many others just because it's helpful since we've talked about it. Here is somebody who is, you know, almost 92 today, who spent 4 years of childhood going through Nazi-occupied France as a kid. And the experience he had was his parents felt that the safest thing for him was going to be placed in a home from somebody with the resistance for a couple of months, left him alone there for a few months, then got him again and moved him somewhere else. So talk about disrupted attachment, right? I mean, he had four fundamental years where it was constantly being interrupted. Poverty, often having to find food for himself. I mean, really a challenging childhood. And yet, in the background was always these parents who were there for him. And he knew that. He knew that deeply. Okay. But he also was tough, very, very tough. He came to the United States when he was, you know, only 19 to go to college by himself. I mean, he is the epitome of resilience. He's an alpinist. I mean, he is just the most robust person I know. Part biology, part support from the environment. Okay. So we can move up and down the scale. Okay. But part of it is our biology and part of it is the support systems. That's important because what we are seeing is when we look at individuals who've been exposed to adversity, some respond with trauma and some respond with resilience. They bounce back from it. And the science is now becoming much more informative in terms of why. We can now see, for example, that simply because of the biology, some children robustly respond, for example, to neglect because they've been gifted, due to biology, a stronger what's called the executive system, these systems of memory, attention, and self-regulation. Some have been gifted a less robust executive system, and they're more vulnerable to that deprivation. And so what that now tells us is that when we see children who have been exposed to neglect and deprivation, we need to see what impact it has on those key developmental systems so that those who are on the more vulnerable end, we can supply them with the relevant experiences to build that system up. Some are going to bounce back because they've been, again, born with much more robust executive systems to deal with that neglect.
So that made me think about people dealing with grief. And I'm thinking about clients of mine, and I can see certain people dealing with the, let's say, parents who have lost their child. So it's the same loss, specifically the same loss. But one of the couples will respond to it in a much more resilient way than the other. Would that be equally representative of what you were just saying in terms of the biology of one parent versus the other? Would you be able to say something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the individual cases, it's difficult sometimes to disentangle how much is biology and how much is environment, or how much is nature and how much is nurture. But I think what's key here, because we know that positive experiences that people have can buoy them to being resilient to adverse experiences. One of the things that I like to point to, and this again may be a nice example for people, is some of your listeners will be familiar with the musician Sinead O'Connor, who passed away recently about a year ago. I'd encourage people who haven't done this is that if they are familiar with Sinead O'Connor and haven't read her autobiography, go look up some pictures of her when she was a young teen. She is a sparkling, vivacious, her face just is brilliant. It's smiley. The eyes are sparkling. That is a young teen who was being abused by her mother. And you wouldn't know it by looking at her. And the reason I mention that is because, of course, she suffered greatly from that history of abuse. But what you see on the surface is not necessarily an indication of the pain and suffering going below the surface. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important for practitioners not to make assumptions about what they're seeing at the surface. We now know, again, from a rich science, that individuals who are born with a stronger system of self-control or self-regulation often are able to surmount at some level surmount certain kinds of deprivation or abuse that they've experienced as children because they've got strong self-control. But by constantly having to exert self-control, they're effectively aging themselves. The stress of keeping things under wraps, although it looks good on the surface, is in some ways killing their immune systems. And so again, without going too much into the weeds of the science, we know from genetic studies, in fact, epigenetic, which is basically a wearing of our biological clocks, that keeping things under wraps, keeping things under control, is aging us faster. So what happens is our biological clock is getting detached from our chronology. Mm-hmm. So we may be 40 years old, but we've got the internal system of a 50-year-old. And so that is a key message, again, for different practitioners, because that biological aging is a wear and tear on the system. It's like your car looks all shiny and good, but the brakes have given away. We don't see that. Yeah. And so that's the key piece for the practitioner, is they may look fine on the surface, but what's tucked beneath may be really hurting.
Yeah. And it's so beautiful what you say, because it just relates to what I have been researching in my own sense. You mentioned also there it results in heightened inflammation, compromised immune system, and so forth. So a lot of people, not the children and not the young adults, but the older adults will say, well, okay, they're dealing with a system that has been used more than their biological age would expect. Wow. This has been really interesting, and I haven't even asked any questions that I have here that I wanted to ask even more. But this has been highly enlightening, and for those people who want to know more, there's obviously the book that Mark has just released, and you'll find all the links in the show notes as usual. And also there's the other episode on developmental trauma that you can go and listen to also in season 6. So I highly recommend that. And as we said, go check out that book, which has so much more than we could share in those 40 minutes here. But if you were to summarize, is there anything that you want those people listening to this podcast would want them to know, if you were to boil it down to something that they would take away from today?
Yeah, I think the piece that I would sort of take away are a couple of key bullet points. One is to recognize that these different types of adverse childhood experiences are common, that these are not rare events. I didn't mention today, but just quickly, the World Health Organization estimates that 1 billion children every year are maltreated all over the globe. This is not something that's unique to wealthy or poor countries, democracies or dictatorships, highly religious or not. They are common to humanity. That's a sad state of affairs in many ways, but it also gives us a call to arms to help. And that help can only come from recognizing the fact that there are these different traumatic signatures, and those different traumatic signatures are really cries for help, that we think about the signature so that we can help design different kinds of interventions to help children recover from those different signatures. And there I'd introduce this idea of a kind of a trauma toolkit. There's not one type of help. Therapy is one, and it's a wonderful thing for some people, depending on what they've experienced. But there are many other kinds of ways that we can help children or adults with childhood trauma recover from that. So I'd encourage a breadth of trauma types of interventions. And then the lastly is that thing is that we really need a community of professionals to be invested in understanding this topic, because it is a community of professionals, not just teachers, not just parents, not just doctors or social workers, but all that are ultimately going to help people better recover from the experiences they've had.
Absolutely. I can absolutely subscribe to what you just said. Thank you so much, Mark. But we're going to finish, if you are okay with it, with the rapid fire question, which I ask all of my guests. Would that be okay?
Sure.
So what does grieving and trauma means to you in the light of your specific area of research and scientific knowledge and experience?
So grieving for me is a kind of response to loss, of what someone's lost, that often goes along with the emotion of sadness and sometimes of regret. And I think those are rich and complicated emotions that for each individual needs to be pulled apart so they see what is the source of it, and where is that coming from. The traumatic response to me is really the scarring of the body and brain. And it's how our bodies respond to adverse experiences. And here, as we've talked about today, I would encourage people to think about the signatures that can be observed for the individual. Are they finding that their own sense of identity has been lost? Are they finding that because of experience, they're hypervigilant about their environment? Do they find that they're generalizing to all sorts of situations that maybe are not productive for them? So I think it's learning about how our bodies and brains respond to the adverse experiences. I think that's fundamental for recovery.
So what does healing mean to you in that context?
So for me, healing is the process of acknowledging in some ways what the experience was that has been traumatic for you, the loss, whatever the loss is, and then learning to cope with that in a way that allows one to in some ways move on with one's life and to continue to live a meaningful life that is meaningful to one's own sense of self and to the others that we interact with.
And what have you learned about yourself in the light of loss and trauma, and what you have learned from your research?
I think for me, it's realized in some ways the luckiness of my own life, that I had the great benefit of amazing parents who provided me with a foundation that, for example, my two daughters had a different kind of life. They had a wonderful life, I hope, they feel, from me. But then I look at all the children I work with and see who've not had the benefit I've had. But it's taking the privilege I had of incredible parents and using that to guide the work I do with children who've had less.
And what would be one specific thing that has changed since your loss? So, for example, the loss of your mother more specifically, that you wouldn't want to miss?
I think I've often thought about my loss with my mother or some of the children I've worked with who have passed away to not waste time helping others. Because I think, to me, I see all the possibility in children. And I think for me, it's not wasting any time spending with children who need more. So for me, I think there's probably never going to be retirement because there's so much that I think can be done that I hope I can contribute to helping others.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for the time that you spent with me today and how you enlightened not just mine, hopefully also the other listeners' brains on the understanding of adverse childhood experience and how it can impact and how we can actually help people understanding their signatures of trauma and also with their signatures of resilience. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Natalie. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimmelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30-minute free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.